Welcome to Copenhagen Daily, reporting from the Bella Center in Copenhagen, on what is undoubtedly the most important meeting in human history. Welcome to Copenhagen Daily, reporting from the Bella Center, where the UN Climate Change Summit is taking place. And we're a little bit up against the clock, in the same way as the negotiations are, rapidly running out of time. So I'm going to have to improvise a narrative. Won't be the first time I've done this, but I'm improvising it again today. Action-packed show. And we're going to start with an interview done by Arthur with Professor John Schellnhuber, asking, are the negotiations grounded in science currently? That's the first point of assessment for these talks. If they're not based in science, if they're not going to fix the problem, adequate to fix the problem of climate change, then they won't do the trick. So this is John Schellnhuber.
My name is John Schellnhuber. I'm director of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research, and I'm also advising the German government on climate issues.
Okay, excellent. To what extent would you say that the negotiations at the moment are actually grounded in science and the actual scientific background for climate change?
Yeah, to some extent they are, but of course they are grounded in the last IPCC report, which was published in 2007 and which, in a sense, only considered papers published by 2005. So we are at least 4 years behind the science, if you like. And in particular, we have now found out clearly that it is more or less the cumulative emissions of CO2 that really matter, what we call the budget approach to climate protection. And that has certainly not sunk into the political negotiations so far.
The target that frames the negotiations is always 2 degrees centigrade, but from what's on the table at the moment, where do you think we are? How close are we to that?
Actually, we have developed at our institute a sort of software for directly calculating from the pledges on the table what the probable mean global temperature change will be, and we are currently at 3.8 degrees warming. That is what the negotiations have achieved so far.
Right, okay. So are you hopeful that, you know, we can increase that to maybe, bring it under the 2 degrees target in the next week?
Well, it would be a dream, more or less. Dreams sometimes come true, but in general not. I think we can at least achieve two things, namely that the upper limit is definitely lower than 3.8 degrees, so I don't know, 3 degrees or even lower, plus a process, and that's very important, to even improve the target, or even improve not the target, but the achievement, really, because I do not think this is the all-decisive conference. It's the first conference in a set of conferences, and if we, by 2015, have a revision, for example, of the deal which is set up now, which makes absolutely clear and sure that we achieve the 2 degrees target, then it would be fine.
Do you think perhaps there's a new way of looking at this problem that's required, you know, actually looking at the amount of carbon dioxide or CO2 equivalents that we have left to emit into the atmosphere?
No, absolutely. I think we need the most robust scientific principles on the one hand, and fortunately we have a very simple relationship between the total amount of emissions over the next 40 years and the response in global warming. So that's the one thing, a very robust scientific finding. So it should be the basis, of course, a political compass, if you like, or a compass for policymakers. And the other thing is we need very robust principles for burden sharing, and they are not even discussed, actually. So we still have the pure bottom-up approach. What does country X provide, so to speak, because of the Senate or because of the political system. And then we just sum it up and see where we come, where we go. Why we need the top-down approach, at least for starting the negotiations. What are the robust principles? In the end, it will be nitty-gritty and fine-tuning, of course. But let's leave that to the bureaucrats.
Okay, and you said that, you know, if we have a budget-based approach, then, you know, we need to divide up between those countries that, you know, can tackle the problem. That means that we've got very steep emissions reduction curves if we're to be within that budget. How fast do you think we can reduce emissions? What is possible, do you think?
Okay, so I did not talk about feasibility in technical terms, of course. But we did this calculation that if the budget would be divided globally in a just way, but you allow for emissions trading. So there are many countries in the world, including India, who cannot exhaust their budget, so to speak. According to the allocation, they could emit more than they are even able to emit. So if you take that into account, so you have flexible instruments, emissions trading and so on, then we can achieve it. But it means that, say, Europe, for example, should go in total for a 40% reduction by 2020. So far, only Germany has the target, I know.
And that's without offsetting, is it?
Without offsetting, actually, yeah. And the United States, of course, it's almost ridiculous if I put on the table now, I think, 3% reduction as compared to 1990 by 2020. If the richest and the technologically most powerful country in the world is not willing to do better, I mean, then, of course, the case is hopeless.
Okay, and you've also said, finally, you have referred to the fact that, you know, the later we leave it, the sharper we'll have to cut emissions.
That is the essence of the whole argument, actually, yeah? Because people have always thought, well, CO2 goes into the atmosphere, but it will be washed away again by rain and whatever, weathering and things like that. Unfortunately, 20% of the CO2 remains in the atmosphere for 5,000 years or so. So every year we lose now, pumping up more than 30 billion tons of CO2 every year into the atmosphere. These are completely lost year. Undoing it is, at the present stage of technology, not possible. So yes, if we waste another 5 years, then we probably miss the boat.
And say we waste another 5 years, another 10 years, before we actually start to really try and get in onto this budget, how quick will we have to reduce emissions?
No, as I said, I mean, if we wait 10 more years, when it will be 9% reduction per year, so if we start peaking only in 2020, but you should not confuse the peaking year with the starting or the initiating of measures. Every measure we start now is helping us to stay within the budget. As I said, it has to be a dynamical process, but definitely if we would wait more than 10 years, so beyond 2020, to peak global emissions, then I think the problem cannot be solved anymore.
Okay. Are you still optimistic?
No, I have prescribed myself, or have given myself the prescription to be optimistic. I mean, what point would it be to come here if you are not basically optimistic about the whole thing? I think if we miss the boat, we have a long time, almost eternity, in order to be pessimistic.
Meanwhile, Tom Besley has been exploring the joys of cycling in Denmark, and there's a big cycling action coming up at the end of the week, and here he is, sounding exhausted, pedalling away.
Okay, so I just found a bike, and I'm cycling through Copenhagen to the bike block. Copenhagen's a very, very kind of bike-friendly city. The etiquette here, really, is that as long as the bike isn't locked, and you're not using angle grinders to get it, it's pretty much acceptable to take it off the street and kind of make it your own. So last night, we were in Roskilde, about 20 minutes outside of Copenhagen. We found a big pile of bikes, and now we're cycling them to the Candy Factory, which is a bike hacking workshop on the outskirts of Copenhagen, and we're going to turn these bikes into tools of protest. I'm exhausted because I've actually got my bike, my bags on me. Okay, so now we're on the road, got a properly working bike, just been down at the Candy Factory, which is it's a bike shop, about 20 minutes outside Copenhagen town centre, and the place is incredible. Like, they've been collecting bikes for the last month, and they're just stacks and stacks and stacks of wrecked bikes. They're kind of bike technicians who are helping people out, showing people how to fix a bike up. Like piles of tools everywhere, there's axle grinders, lots of noise, lots of music just as I was coming out there. There's people gathered around a fire playing accordions. And now I'm cycling to meet the rest of the bike blockers. We're going to do some training. The day of action is on Wednesday, 16th. And more of that a bit later on. Okay, so I'm at the bike block training, and they're probably about like 40, 50, about 100 people here, and the police have just turned up. We've been training all different tactics of how you can use bikes to back off like police charges and when they use batons and things like that. But it seems like we've been spotted, and Jay from the Lab of Inspector Imagination. This is the second van of police coppers tanning up. Okay, so there are two vans. There are probably about like 20, 25 police officers inside. Apparently they're checking us to see if we've all got working lights. Right, so I don't think we're going to move out. We're going to stay here and carry on what we're doing under the close observant eye of the Copenhagen police. More when it happens. Quick one. We've just been playing Hug It, and the police are watching us. Came over and gave Jay a hug, which is lovely.
Diving into the nitty-gritty of the talks now with a report from Frederica Whitehead, which lifts the lid on some of the problems with the Clean Development Mechanism. This is the highly controversial carbon trading mechanism which came out of the Kyoto talks in 1997. 12 years after Kyoto, corporate interests are gathered around the honeypot again, hoping to gain credits for highly contentious approaches to solving climate change. Think that the Clean Development Mechanism is about clean, renewable energy? Think again. Corporate lobbyists are pushing for nuclear energy, so-called clean coal technology, and incinerators to be designated as clean technologies. But what's this all got to do with the millions of people who earn their living as waste pickers? Frederica Whitehead investigates.
This is Climate Radio. I'm Frederica Whitehead, and I'm speaking to Neil Tangri, and he's the Climate Change Campaign Director from GAIA, which is the Global Alliance for Incinerator Alternatives. Here at the UNFCCC, there has been a new bit of terminology that hasn't been used a lot in the ecology press in Britain, as far as I know, which is waste pickers. Waste pickers, as far as I understand it, Neil, is a kind of catch-all term for people that make their living from recycling in the developing world. What I want to know is, what does your alliance want from these talks? What do you want these negotiators to do for you?
A good outcome, come specifically for the waste pickers, would be recognition, not only in words, but in finance, because money talks. As you're saying, waste pickers, a is a term for people who make a living by recycling waste in the developing world. And the recycling systems in most of the world are not a blue bin that you put outside at the curb. They are poor people who go through the trash and pick out materials that can be recycled. And in doing that, they're delivering us all a huge favor, because recycling waste is actually a major mitigation activity. It reduces emissions from landfills and incinerators, but it also reduces emissions because it's replacing raw materials such as trees. When you recycle paper, that's fewer trees being cut down, and so we're saving emissions all along the line. And what the waste pickers are hoping for is recognition of their work and financial support of their work and the ability to expand that so that they can recycle more, which will mean more mitigation and will also, of course, improve their livelihoods. And the challenge that they're confronting right now is actually the Clean Development Mechanism. The CDM is supporting a variety of waste-to-energy technologies, incineration, landfill gas, under the guise of reducing emissions. But in fact, what's happening is that these technologies come in and they're in direct competition with the existing informal sector recycling system. And so we see recycling rates drop, which means emissions increase, and already poor people are further impoverished. And we're not talking a small number of people. We're talking about 15 to 20 million people around the world. So the CDM is clearly working against both of its equal priorities, which is to finance emissions reductions and to finance sustainable development. And that's why we're calling for the CDM to stop funding incinerators and landfills. And instead, we're calling for a global climate fund, a non-market-based mechanism, which is going to have direct access by waste picker groups and other grassroots organizations in order to get money directly to the poor people who are already making the huge mitigation contribution that they do in their daily work and can do even more with the right support.
Okay, that's very interesting. Just in the really simplistic terms, what you're effectively telling listeners who aren't fully up on the policy is that incinerators are being funded under the guise of renewable energy. Am I correct?
Yes, that's exactly correct. Incinerators and landfill gas. And we're seeing this as a global trend. It's not only under the Clean Development Mechanism, but in the U.S., the Renewable Energy Standard includes incinerators and landfill gas. We're seeing more and more carbon credits in various forms flowing to these technologies. And it's nonsense. I mean, people are a little bit astonished when I tell them that actually incinerators are being considered clean energy, but that's what happens when you take your eye off politicians.
Thank you. We just heard Neil Tangri criticising the inclusion of incineration projects in the Clean Development Mechanism. CDM committee is sitting now, and we will be keeping track of its decisions throughout this series. The Clean Development Mechanism is a crucial instrument of the Copenhagen Treaty, and if it gets fudged, it could make nonsense of any agreement. It's a policy mechanism that came out of the Kyoto Protocol. The theory is that rich countries and corporations can invest in ventures that reduce emissions in developing countries. If this worked, this would help poorer countries to bypass coal and go straight to renewable energies. One of the contentious issues, and there are several, is over which industries manage to label themselves as clean and are therefore able to draw funds from this pot. It is likely that the Copenhagen Treaty will perpetuate the current situation where incineration projects, like the one Neil Tangri was just speaking of, continue to be able to draw funds. It might even be opened up further to allow coal power stations operating carbon capture and storage, or even nuclear projects, to get their hands on this money. Vast teams of lobbyists working for the coal, nuclear and incineration industries are here in Copenhagen right now trying to affect this treaty. Here's Trish Harrop from Greenpeace Sydney on this issue.
There's a big push at the climate talks in Copenhagen to have CCS included in the Clean Development Mechanism, but it is an unproven technology, and it is also a technology that relies on coal, and so will lock in a carbon dependency for any developing countries that take up this so-called clean coal technology. For those reasons, it shouldn't be included in a mechanism that was supposed to support sustainable development.
And I understand that nuclear is also listed as something that could be funded with CDM money.
Again, countries are pushing for nuclear to be included in the clean development mechanism. That's an incredibly expensive technology, and whilst it may not have any carbon sources at the smokestack, it certainly is carbon intensive in its production, in terms of mining, etc. But also, we know this is not a safe technology. We know that there is no long-term solution to the burial of radioactive waste, and we know that it could lead to greater weapons proliferation. Therefore, it shouldn't be placed in a mechanism that is supposed to support sustainable development.
Can you tell me which countries are trying to push this through? Who are the, what are their positions on this?
Countries most vocal in calling for carbon capture and storage, and they are incredibly vocal, are countries like Saudi Arabia and other OPEC countries. They see this as a way of getting money to help them improve the economic return on their depleting oil wells through pumping in more CO2, which they'll be paid to do, which is quite ironic. So they'll improve the economic return on oil and therefore be able to pump out more of it, which we know will lead to greater greenhouse gas emissions, but all in a mechanism that's supposed to be reducing the amount of greenhouse gas emissions. It's also strongly supported by Australia, the world's largest coal exporter. The nuclear is being supported by those countries that have nuclear technology that they'd like to sell to the world, so countries like Japan and some of the EU countries, particularly France.
A lot of the critics of the CDM make the point that it enables businesses to be paid twice. In fact, they're being paid from the CDM for doing something that they would be doing anyway. Can you explain how companies are getting away with that?
Well, studies have shown that somewhere between 40 and 70% of the projects that are listed under the Clean Development Mechanism not meeting the criteria of additionality. That is, they'd happen anyway, and therefore they don't deserve to earn permits for the alleged saving in greenhouse emissions, because they're simply not saving any greenhouse emissions. The emissions are continuing to occur in developed and developing countries.
There's also, I understand, an issue of regional distribution of CDM monies.
One of the big criticisms of the CDM is the lack of regional distribution. Almost all of the projects are occurring in the biggest developing countries, China, India and Brazil. And the projects are not being run and benefiting the poorer nations and smaller nations in the Pacific and in Africa. And it's those countries that most desperately need access to finance to help them have clean technologies adopted in their countries.
So why do the bigger countries get the money and the smaller countries not?
The bigger countries are getting the projects because they are the countries in which developed countries are interested in doing business. They want access to those markets, and if the CDM helps make that more profitable, well and good. They're simply not interested in the complexity of building smaller scale, truly clean technologies in countries that desperately need it, as in Pacific and African nations.
So what do you want from this conference? What do you want the delegates here to do to make this situation better?
In Copenhagen, the negotiators are concluding their discussions on how to improve the clean development mechanism. They've been talking about it for 2 years. They need to make some decisions on how they could scale down the overall scope of the CDM and get it focused on those small developing nations that don't have the ability on their own to develop clean technologies.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Thanks. That was Trish Harrop of Greenpeace Sydney. We spoke minutes before she went in to speak to the Clean Development Mechanism Committee about the new treaty. We will find out late on Tuesday night, or maybe on Wednesday, what the committee has decided, and Trish has promised to talk to us again as soon as she knows anything. Let's go back to Neil Tangri. He has an example of one of the projects that was funded by the CDM in 2007.
So we have this ridiculous situation in New Delhi where the Timarpur incinerator was opened in the 1980s and could not actually function because the waste pickers there were recycling so much of the material that there was nothing left to burn. And now that project, 20 years later, is getting CDM credits to try and again take that same non-burnable waste, dry it out, and try to burn it.
I'm going to give the last word for today on this matter to Payal Parekh. Payal is a climate campaigner at International Rivers and an expert in the CDM. I asked Payal how she thought the negotiations were going.
With regards to the CDM, it's terrible. The fixes that are on the table are band-aids. They don't deal with the fundamental problems of the CDM. And what this essentially means is we'll continue to have a mechanism that lacks any environmental integrity, and local communities will continue to be affected by adverse social and environmental impacts from projects.
Can you give me a flavour of what's on the table in these negotiations?
Well, there's a whole host of proposed reforms. Some of them you could definitely not call reforms. They include adding nuclear and CCS, carbon capture and storage, under CDM. Currently, both of these technologies are prohibited. Other reforms include trying to improve the geographical distribution of the CDM because of the fact that developing countries, the least developed countries, are not able to take advantage of this mechanism. And as well as you have reforms that try to deal with the fact that a portion of the emissions reductions are not actually real. Unfortunately, from our perspective, these are all band-aid fixes, and the concept of the CDM is fundamentally flawed. And additionally, from a justice perspective, it shifts the burden of making emissions reductions from developed countries to developing countries, and it's, in some sense, you could call it a get-out-of-jail-for-free card for developed countries.
Can you tell me what you would propose? It sounds to me that you're critical of the CDM. What would you propose replacing it with?
I think what we need to replace it with is a fund-based mechanism. And not only do developed countries have an obligation to reduce their emissions, they also have an obligation to support mitigation actions in developing countries. So this fund could very easily be supplied with money from developed countries to fulfill this dual obligation.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Can you give me an idea of the timetable of these negotiations? When might we hear the results?
It's really hard to say because the negotiations are really fluid and extremely dynamic. But we do expect that some of the decisions will actually not be made by negotiators, but go up to the ministerial level. For example, in the case of carbon capture and storage, and this is quite scary because we know what will happen is horse trading. And as an example, Brazil is one of the most vociferous opponents of CCS. But Brazil would very much like to have something called forest in exhaustion. It essentially would award credits to owners of plantations who say that they would not harvest the wood. And as you can see, this is very dangerous, but the EU would very much like CCS to get in, so you could see that there could be some trading going on, which the net effect would be a further undermining of the environmental integrity of the mechanism.
So we should watch this space effectively?
Yes, very closely.
Okay. Thank you so much. I'm Frederica Whitehead. This is Climate Radio on Resonance FM, and we will come back to the subject of the Clean Development Mechanism as soon as there is further information.
We heard the other day how the draft text on deforestation here at the Copenhagen Climate Talks is currently highly inadequate and is unlikely to work. In a satirical move, some youth here have connected here with the Rainforest Action Network, lined the corridors today to sing this version of the 12 Days of Christmas.
Ready? One, two, three. On the first day in Denmark, the UN gave to me a big fat logging subsidy. On the second day in Denmark, the UN gave to me no strings attached and a big fat logging subsidy. On the third day in Denmark, the UN gave to me strings to any song, no strings attached, and a big fat logging subsidy. On the fourth day in Denmark, the UN gave to me too much fossil fuels, trees chain sword, no strings attached, and a big fat logging subsidy. On the fifth day in Denmark, the UN gave to me
fossil fuels, trees, chainsaw, no strings attached, and a big fat logging subsidy. On the 6th day in Denmark, the UN gave to me forest conversion, crap MRV. Too much fossil fuels, trees, chainsaw, no strings attached, and a big fat logging subsidy. On the 7th day in Denmark, the UN gave to me endangered species, forest conversion, crap MRV. Too much fossil fuels, trees, chainsaw, no strings attached, and a big fat logging subsidy. On the 8th day in Denmark, the UN gave to me peatlands and training, endangered species, forest converted, crap MRV. Too much fossil fuels, trees, chainsaw, no strings attached, and a big fat logging subsidy. On the 9th day in Denmark, the UN gave to me no indigenous rights, peatlands of training, endangered species, forest converted, crap MRV. Too much fossil fuels, trees, chainsaw, no strings attached, and a big fat logging subsidy. On the 10th day in Denmark, the UN gave to me emissions of reaping, no indigenous rights, peatlands of draining, endangered species, forest converted, crap MRV. Too much fossil fuels, trees, chainsaw, no strings attached, and a big fat logging subsidy. On the 11th day in Denmark, the UN gave to me ecosystems crashing, emissions are leaping, no indigenous rights, peatlands are draining, endangered species, forest converted, crap MRV. Too much fossil fuels, trees, chainsaw, no strings attached, and a big fat logging subsidy. On the 12th day in Denmark, the UN gave to me palm oil are flowing, ecosystems crashing, emissions are leaping, no indigenous rights, peatlands are draining, endangered species, forest converted, crap MRV. Too much fossil fuels, trees, chainsaw, no strings attached, and a big fat logging subsidy. On the 13th day in Denmark, the UN gave to me no demand side measures, ecosystems crashing, palm oil are flowing, emissions are leaping, no indigenous rights, peatlands are draining, endangered species, forest converted, crap MRV. Too much fossil fuels, trees, chainsaw, no strings attached, and a big fat logging subsidy. On the last day in Denmark, the UN gave to me pathetic little targets, no demand side measures, ecosystems crashing, palm oil are flowing, emissions are leaping, no indigenous rights, peatlands are draining, endangered species, forest converted, crap MRV. Too much fossil fuels, trees, chainsaw, no strings attached, and a big fat logging subsidy.
One of the 12 days there was demand side measures, which means that tackling deforestation can only work if rich countries do something to tackle their rapacious demand for the products which are resulting in forests being cut down. Two of those things, very big in Europe, heavily meat-intensive diets and biofuels. And I spoke to Adrian Bebb of Friends of the Earth about those two issues. So I'm here with Adrian Bebb, a coordinator of Friends of the Earth's food and farming campaign. And there's a whole raft of discussions right now on deforestation in relation to the United Nations climate talks. The demand side of the equation isn't in the draft text, as I understand it, in any operational sense. And yet people like the Ecosystems Climate Alliance have been saying red won't work unless the demand side, Western consumption of forest-related goods and or the land that is required for those goods that comes from forests is dealt with. So perhaps we can deal with those two aspects. Can you say what kind of impacts Europe's consumption of biofuels and heavily kind of meat-intensive diets is having on the forest, what the link is?
Well, it's quite clear that the way we produce food and the way we farm land and also for new biofuels, which is a new issue, is having a huge impact on the climate. And if you just take one sector, the livestock sector, then the estimates are that, you know, it's the same emissions as all the cars and lorries in the world. So we're talking about huge impacts. And, you know, agricultural land covers a third of all the land on the planet. So any agreement here has got to take agriculture into account.
What do you think are the solutions for curbing demand of those two big drivers?
Well, we've got to look for a start at the meat consumption. Meat consumption in northern countries is already leading to unhealthy society, and that's quite clear message coming from health professionals. And what we're seeing now is also that it's causing huge climate problems as well. So we're going to have to tackle the overconsumption of meat and dairy products in northern countries. Some of that could come from these negotiations here. That could send a very strong signal of what's needed over the next 10 to 15 years. And also we need to look at biofuels, as it's quite clearly another area which could be contributing to climate change. And we want to see there a pulling back of the targets which have been set into stone by, you know, areas like the European Union and also America.
Okay. There's a review, I understand, in relation to biofuels in Europe. How quickly is that going to turn around, do you think, and is there an opportunity to get a moratorium in view of the, you know, some of the science which is now saying that biofuels are actually causing more emissions when you look at the total land use picture than perhaps even fossil fuels? There's strong new evidence base there that would suggest a moratorium could be a good solution.
Well, it's quite clear the science around biofuels is evolving very, very fast. And even though legislation was set only last year, what we're seeing now is that most of the biofuels are worse for the planet than they are for any benefit. What we need to do is have a look at this new research, which is going to be, it's coming out now, and review these targets and stop creating a new market for a product which is going to actually create more damage to the planet than fossil fuels itself.
In terms of curbing demand of Western consumption of meat, what kind of scale of dietary change do you think is necessary, and how do you go about bringing that about? You can't presumably just rely on warm messages coming from Friends of the Earth or whatever to try and convince people for this to happen. Is there an opportunity in reforming the Common Agricultural Policy, which I believe there's a review of as well coming up?
It's quite clear that we're going to have quite major lifestyle changes if we're going to avert the worst cases of climate change. And one of those areas is meat consumption and dairy consumption. And research from Friends of the Earth shows that we need to reduce that by about 60%. We're not saying that people don't eat meat and they don't drink milk or eat cheese or whatever, but we have to quite clearly make some changes if we want to avert climate change. So there's plenty of opportunities coming up, and in particular that there's going to be a major reform, one of the biggest reforms ever of the Common Agriculture Policy. This is where all the money is given out to farming, and this at the moment is creating a system which is bad for climate change. And what we need to do is actually change it into a system which is good for climate change, and it allows public to have a wider choice, but it also supports small-scale farming, it supports more ecological farming, and it's creating a farming system which is, at the end of the day, is going to help us solve the problems of climate change instead of creating more problems.
Perhaps you can just clarify the connection between consumption of meat in Europe and deforestation in the Amazon. I mean, what is the link there?
Well, the way we produce meat and dairy products is mainly through intensive farming here in Europe, mainly in factory farms, which are growing and growing across especially Eastern Europe. And these animals need feeding, and this feed comes in the form of soy, which has been planted in South America. And to cope with the increase in meat and dairy consumption and the increase in factory farms, we have to grow more and more soy. And what we're seeing is a massive increase in farming in Latin America, which means deforesting areas like the Amazon, and this is leading to massive climate emissions. And all this is being converted to land to grow soy, which is then shipped across to Europe to feed our factory farms. And this is the link we need to change, and this is why we need to challenge things like the agriculture policies of Europe, and also to bring the agriculture into negotiations here in Copenhagen.
You hear some people, I think even the UN's Livestock's Long Shadow report, one of their kind of solutions seemed to be more intensification of the livestock industry. What do you make of that approach?
Well, the way we produce meat and dairy at the moment is a complete failure. It's not only a failure in terms of the climate change, but it's also causing huge amounts of pollution. It's bad for farmers. You're talking about big agribusiness taking over the whole food chain. And this is the thing that's got to change, because it's quite clear we can't carry on as we were before. And I think, you know, the research is showing that livestock is one of the major contributors to climate change, and there's solutions out there. The solution out there is changing agricultural policy, that we actually support much more smaller scale farming, which is much more people friendly, farmer friendly. It's better for the environment and it's better for the climate.
Another action in Copenhagen today connected with the issue of climate refugees, and Arthur was there to pick up this report.
Israel's Platz in the centre of Copenhagen. There's a big rally here today against borders and frontiers. This march should be heading towards the Danish Ministry of Defence. Seems like quite a good turnout here. There's probably at least 1,000 or more people here. So what's the connection between this rally and the climate summit for you?
Well, this rally is going to the foreign ministry, and it's because if we don't do anything about climate change, right, you're going to end up with lots of climate refugees, and people got to be willing to either do something about climate change or be willing to take in more refugees, which Denmark isn't exactly very good at.
We just go past the school, and all the kids are waving out of the windows. Everyone's trying to encourage them to come down and join us, but it doesn't look like they're going to. Seem to be having a good time, though. Well, why are you here in this square today?
Why? Because it's important to give a strong message for that people are ready to change the system, that is necessary to change the system, not the climate.
It's quite interesting to see this issue also being represented at the UN climate talks, which obviously become a growing issue as climate change takes hold.
Here's a quick audio boo from Tom Besley.
Hi, I've just woken up on Sunday the 13th, and I'm in a cooperative in Roskilde. How many people living here?
Nine
people living here, and I'm here with four of them, so we'll just do a round circle. Introduce yourself.
Yeah, I'm Thijs.
And Nana.
And I'm Miguel.
And I'm Jeppe.
And you guys have been really, really kind to us, so we're really grateful that you've had us on board. Are you kind of the only group doing this, or are there other groups that you know of?
I know. I think in Roskilde we are the only one who do it, but I think in Copenhagen there are several people who are doing this. So it's quite cool. But here it's only us.
It's just you guys. And how did you get in touch with the Scottish activists?
I know a person from the logistics group in Climate Justice Action, and I wrote for her, and then I got the email for Dan, and then I contacted y'all, and suddenly you text me yesterday, and I just got you from the station, so that's pretty much it.
Yeah, it's such a lovely house as well. There's like a vegetable patch out back, and are you going to be growing stuff on that maybe next year?
Oh yeah, we are vegetables of all kinds, and we have a lot of apples, and so, yeah.
But what's the mood been like before we arrived? Have you felt, in Copenhagen especially, have you felt as if it's getting ready for a big summit, or has it been quite calm?
It's been quite hectic. People all over the city, and it's just like posters everywhere, and people just like, it's a big anarchist zone in Copenhagen right now. It's so cool.
And is this different to how it normally is?
Oh yeah, very different. There are info points all over the places, and we have got signs to tell you where to go when you are in Copenhagen, so that you can find those info points. So it's very different.
And do you think it will change? I mean, do you think it will change after people have left? Or do you think this feeling will carry on? Like, do you think there'll be some momentum?
I hope that'll be the same, but I fear that people are going to relax again afterwards, because they have really used so much energy to this summit. Yeah. So, but we'll find out.
And just a quick question about last week, because we only arrived yesterday. Was there anything, any protests that you guys attended that were worth mentioning?
Well, that's been like banner drops and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
Pretty much also here in Roskilde and in Copenhagen. A lot of people going out doing like small stuff, but still like to get the message across and telling people that it's something you need to focus on. So that's pretty cool.
And as a group, do you have any particular themes that you focus on, like in relation to climate? Like, do you look at food production, or do you look at like short haul flights, or is it just a general attitude that you have?
Well, I'm on the anti-capitalist wing. I mean that we need a system change and not only the climate change, because it's the capitalism who smashes the climate, and that's the thing that we have to switch out.
Any closing remark?
Well, we just
go
want
vegan.
Go vegan. We need a better place.
Yeah,
we need a better world.
Unless something remarkable happens over the next few days, these talks are going to end in crisis. As Salim al-Huq explains, all countries now need to abandon their obsession with getting the best for their own national interests. What's needed now is for national governments to act in the common interest in order to sort this problem once and for all.
The public in the developed countries need to understand that they need to tell their leaders to take the courageous political decisions that are needed to solve the planetary problem of global warming. This is not a problem of individual countries, and unfortunately many of the leaders think of negotiations in terms of what is it that they can gain for their own countries. It doesn't really matter what they do for their own countries now if the planet itself is destroyed. What they need to do is to understand that they are not negotiating a deal for their country, they are negotiating a deal for the planet. They happen to represent the adults of this generation who are going to decide what to leave behind for their children and their grandchildren. They are not answerable to their citizens of today, they are answerable to their own children, our children of the future. And many of them haven't understood the magnitude of that responsibility yet.
We were hoping to do it table to table, but it seems that there's not enough room in the passageway for us to get to you. But we have a menu of songs, and we'd like people to select something from the menu of songs, and we can sing it for you. If you choose a song, we'll sing it for you. We'll pass it around, but just to let you know, on the menu tonight, as a starter, we have stone cold soup. We've got cheap chicken. Cheap chicken. We've got a grand buffet. Spaghetti carbonara. Oily. Hunting, gathering, scavenging and foraging. Mrs. Beaton, the time traveller. Raw onions and milk. And we have some extinct animals. And I think we're starting with, what are we going to start with?
Well, no, we had an order for fizzy water from here, our first customer.
Okay, we had an order for fizzy water, so we're going to start with fizzy water.
Water is too much, water is too little, water is no more for all. I need water is a call. Wet and splashy, cool and freezy, slurp it down, free and easy, spitty, witty, tasty, wasty.
Whoops, things are turning nasty. Floods and famines follow.
People haven't enough to swallow.
Lots of water everywhere and not a single drop. Lots of water everywhere and not a single drop. April showers. Not enough for flowers.
Thank you.
Daily, every day, from 11 a.m. till noon, throughout the UN Climate Conference on Resonance 104.4 FM and online at resonancefm.com.